Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. In this most recent special episode of Undisclosed, Susan, Colin, and Rabia looked into the blockbuster bail filing in the case of Adnan Syed. The document surprised a lot of people, but is there reason to have real hope for Adnan's release pending a new trial? So with us today are two of the hosts of Undisclosed. We have Susan Simpson. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group, and she blogs at The View from LL2. How you doing, Susan?
Hey.
We also have Colin Miller, associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, who blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. How you doing, Colin?
Pretty good, John. How about you?
I'm doing okay. Doing okay. Also with us today is a very special guest. We have Chris Floor. He began his practice as an attorney in New York and eventually moved to Maryland in 1998, where he began work as the legal director for a grant-funded program focused on bail reform in Baltimore City. He also happened to be one of Adnan Syed's original attorneys. And today, he serves as president of the Maryland Criminal Defense Attorneys Association and an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, thanks very much. I'm actually former president of MCDA, but still an important organization. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yes, we are definitely glad to have you. Actually, it's doubly fascinating for me because you were one of Adnan's very first attorneys. Can I ask, what was your very first impression upon meeting Adnan Syed?
The kid. Just remember feeling, my gosh, you know, I did mostly adult work in New York before I moved here. The bail project was also limited to representing the adult population. And here's this young kid and scared out of his mind. And just, you know, folks, and it's sad when you do this for a long time that there's some people that going through the system is kind of what their lives are about. And that's a pathetically sad thing. But this is a guy that didn't belong right from the start. And that's how I felt about him when I first met him. Still do today.
Did you have like an aha moment when you realized, oh, my goodness, this kid just didn't do this?
I don't know that I had an aha moment, but there was definitely things that didn't make sense, that didn't add up. You know, if you do enough domestic violence cases, you sort of get the sense of the people that, you know, in my mind, their brain's kind of broken. You know, they look at you and they don't understand when they're trying to convey to you, well, this person wronged me, so of course I struck out, you know, against them and so forth. And you look at them and you kind of go, huh? And that's just not, you know, who he is. And it wasn't who he was at the time either. So there was no one aha moment. It was an interesting journey to watch Harrod go through the whole thing of looking for the smoking gun, you know, through serial. And I guess she didn't find it. But, you know, those of us that do this, it's more of a gut feeling than anything. And certainly with all the hard work that so many people have done, I continually to thank folks like you guys, the work that so many people have done and the work that Justin and his team are doing now. It's humbling and gratifying when you think an injustice happened on your watch and that you see it slowly, slowly, slowly getting turned and hopefully being made right.
Well, we got some questions from social media, actually, and one of them was, when you look back on this, is there anything that you felt like you could have done differently in the situation? Because you were his very first attorney. I believe that you were instrumental in hooking up with Christina Gutierrez, who was a very highly regarded lawyer at that time. Is there anything in retrospect that you would change?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, for the record to be clear, Doug Colbert was really lead counsel, and he was my mentor. Doug is an amazing attorney, and he's done more in the area of bail reform than any one human being in the country has. So I want that to be clear. I was able to help, and that was, you know, definitely a gratifying moment in my career, but yet a very difficult one looking back on. And to answer the question, I suppose, knowing how Tina went downhill so rapidly towards the end there, I could still remember when there was discussion of which attorney for the family to hire. And I know at that time, I knew Tina pretty well. I didn't know a lot of the lawyers that were local. I had researched them before I moved down here, but I knew Tina personally. And this case was personal to me because I really thought that there was a innocent young man sitting there on a no bail. So that was one of the reasons I lobbied for her. But if I could reverse the clock, honestly, I wish that the family would have hired Billy. And when I talk about Billy, I'm talking about Billy Murphy. He is and still continues to be just an outstanding advocate. And unfortunately, I had no idea at the beginning stages of how things were going. And I did have some idea as things progressed about her health concerns, but not to the point of how things went downhill so badly And I know she was a prideful person. She was a, as her sister described her at her funeral, I was there for Tina's funeral. You know, she was an artist. And I think it must have been an awful thing to be robbed of your ability to do what was probably the most important thing to her in her life.
So were you representing Anand during the infamous Vicky Wash bail hearing?
Yeah, I was there at the hearing, and I suppose there's certain things that I like to block out of my memory, but in preparation for you guys inviting me here, I reread the transcript, and, you know, lots of bad memories came flooding back, and I read over her so-called apology letter to the court, and I suppose the first thing that struck me, and what I've heard over and over and over again, you can imagine doing the bail project. I personally did so many bail hearings myself, and I supervised many other lawyers in teaching them how to do them effectively. And Doug was the genesis of the whole project. But we heard almost on a daily basis, it felt like, judges telling us, no, this isn't the trial counsel, and I'm not going to get into the facts of the case. And, you know, reading over the transcript, I see exactly that sentiment from Judge Mitchell, who did the writ, and he let Doug, who did the argument, quote, I'm not here to decide whether he's guilty or whether the state has a probable cause question. And that was one of those uphill battles that we're always trying to not get in that position where the court stops us from making the argument, but trying to educate them that, no, the very first factor in all of the bail factors in the Maryland rules is the nature and circumstances of the evidence. And reviewing Doug's argument and how the just tremendous amount of letters we had, folk, the one doctor saying that he would turn himself in addition to the house he was putting up, he was so certain that Adnan wouldn't come back. You know, to get professionals to make statements like that, it's just unheard of. And then hearing the letters from his classmates, which I had forgotten about, and how they felt there's no way, even though they really loved Haman Lee, that they felt that he was the kind of person that could do this, and they did not want a second misfortune to happen. And then I look back at those words and I think of how much water's been under the bridge since that day back in March of 99.
So in the brief that was recently filed arguing for his bail, it cites two major problems with the original bail hearing, which was one, that he was treated as an 18-year-old instead of a minor, a 17-year-old, because he was in fact 17. And also there was the introduction of the so-called evidence of a pattern of Pakistani males leaving the country when they were in situations like this. Do you think, absent those two huge issues, which were huge issues at the time, do you think that it would have been likely that Adnan would have gotten bail?
I mean, it's always an uphill battle when you have a serious case. And I think another interesting point in rereading the transcript was that the judge let Doug know that he was very happy that he had released somebody on recog on a murder one just the day before. But the key phrase in that statement in the transcript is at the request of the prosecutor. And when we don't have the prosecutor's agreement on cases like this, it just becomes a very difficult thing. In fairness to judges who make bail decisions, the unfortunate pattern is, and it doesn't happen with any frequency, but it does happen sometimes, is that when our clients go out and if they do commit another offense, rarely does anybody flee the country, as all the hoopla was back then in the argument. But the media comes to the judge and says, oh my gosh, you know, how did you let this guy out? And they make them look like a buffoon because they released them. So we in the criminal defense community know very few good things can happen to a judge when they actually apply the law and release somebody on a reasonable bail condition. Many bad things can happen to them, and that is a reality of what we have to fight against. I do think that it's outrageous that the arguments were made about the pattern and the so-called information that she had from her expert. And then what's more interesting is in preparing for the conversation, the only reason that came to light was because Doug Colbert contacted this guy and said, hey, this is what was said about what you were quoted as saying in a courtroom. Is that right? And that person didn't want to respond to Doug. And Ms. Wash's letter refers to that conversation. And only after that happened, that he did the digging and the probing, did suddenly a letter get written off to Judge Mitchell saying, you know, well, I didn't mean to mislead the court, but this information's not accurate. And it just continues to boggle my mind. some of the nicest clients I've ever represented seem to have the worst luck in the world. And in cases where you have something that's really hard to like sometimes, they get these tremendous breaks. But seeing not one, but multiple prosecutors in the life of this case do things that are simply outrageous and have absolutely no consequences to their action. None. It just blows my mind, and it continues to blow my mind.
It's time to check in now with one of our tastiest sponsors, Blue Apron. So we talk about and tweet about Blue Apron all the time, but I have a feeling some of you might still not know exactly what Blue Apron is. So right now, as holiday season is approaching us and things are going to get crazier and hairier for a lot of us, Blue Apron can save your life. Blue Apron is a delivery service that every single week will deliver to your home every single thing you need to make delicious home-cooked meals. Every ingredient you need, in the exact proportions you need, along with beautiful recipe cards with these color photographs, step by step, so you can make fresh, wholesome meals for your family. You never have to go to the grocery store, you don't have to scrounge around looking for the right stuff, and you know what, it all costs less than $10 per meal per person, which is less than the cost, really, of most fast food joints. And it's not just healthy food, which I know sometimes can turn off some people. It's actually incredibly delicious food. Premium ingredients, ethically sourced. Things like Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, heirloom tomatoes, fresh produce, meat, everything you need to make the meals. And there's so much variety because every week new recipes are created and they're never repeated in the same year. Every single week, there's different recipes and you can decide which ones you want. And some weeks, hey, if you don't feel like having a delivery done, it's so flexible that you can take the week off. There's no commitment at all. So you only get deliveries when you want them. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free, absolutely free, with free shipping. If you go to blueapron.com/UP, you're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/UP. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Now, I have a probably dumb question, but it sounded like this bail filing is before Judge Welch. Is that correct or am I wrong? Because he's retired, isn't he?
Yes, but he's familiar with the case, and because he made the order, that would be the appropriate person for Justin to address the bail question to.
Oh, because I just pictured him out, you know, fly fishing in a river and his cell phone rings and he's like, ah, this thing.
This case again.
You guys are some killing me.
Some court judges do that, but there's plenty that work pretty hard in their retirement. And they're limited in how frequently they can sit after they retire. But some really sit all around the state and do a lot of important work.
Now, one thing as a layperson I didn't quite understand was, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately. Actually, Brian Frosch, who's the current Attorney General of Maryland, has been talking about reforming the bail system. And you mentioned that that was an issue you were very concerned with. I had forgotten about there's a distinction between when a judge says no bail, which is there's, you know, no possibility of this person getting out before their trial, and when they set just an enormous bail, which would have the same effect. It's unclear to me why a judge would do either. If you're concerned about it, just say no bail.
I guess it's a tough one to answer, not being a judge, but there was a really interesting discussion, and I got to participate briefly in it with Kojo Namde here in D.C., and he had on I believe it was the presiding judge in D.C. I don't practice there, but the judge really courageously came out and talked about the reform of removing the bail bond industry from the D.C. system. And what he said was frequently what judges have done in the past is to pick a number so high that they hope that the defendant cannot make it. And he pointed out that not only is that wrong, but that's actually not a good way to protect the public if the danger equivalent or the danger factor is something that people are looking at. And Brian Frosch's work and leadership on this issue, and there's going to be a proposal to the Rules Committee here in Maryland to change and clarify the rules on this issue, because time and again, I personally have made arguments and supervised other lawyers that have made arguments where the court was not concerned in the least about the defendant's ability to make the bail. They just set it and decide, well, whether it's too high for them to make, well, that's their problem. And that's not what the rules say. And I'm certainly welcome our Attorney General's leadership in that area.
Well, it just seems like, do they have to have a higher bar to prove no bail for some reason? Or I'm just thinking, is there some procedural reason that a no bail is just hard to justify?
It's harder to judge them for it. It's less scrutiny for them and they can pass it off.
I think that, you know, what was said in the written order by Judge Mitchell was is that simply because Adnan was charged with the most serious charge, which wasn't entirely correct because he was not facing the death penalty because of his age, his actual age, that he felt that he would not come back if he was released on any bail condition. And truly one of the most difficult things that any intellectually honest lawyer or judge has to do is reconcile the presumption of innocence with a no bail status. It's, in my mind, not possible. And just because it's been done, all of us that practice law know that much is done in the system based on habit and based on what's always been done beforehand. And as new lawyers, all new lawyers get that sort of shock look, deer in the headlights look on their face that, wow, this isn't in the case books, but this is what's happening in the trenches. And it's really unfortunate when a no bail gets set with the paltry amount of information. And as we all know now, these many years that have passed, how much of that information was just not reliable. And based on a very, very small amount of information, you have to remember at the time that the writ of habeas corpus was argued in circuit court back in March of 99, the indictment wasn't even filed yet. So they're still at an early stage in putting their case together. And to have that kind of thing decided without any sworn testimony, because that is not the normal, though it's possible for a judge to take testimony during a bail hearing. I know there's some discussion about doing that with the upcoming request for Adnan's current bail status, but that doesn't happen. And it's basically what we've heard so many times, and I certainly, you know, want those that are listening to know this, is that there are today judges that will say in a bail hearing across the state of Maryland that they are required to presume the facts in a charging document to be true. And that is absolutely not the case. It's amazing how constitutional principles so frequently will get tossed out the window. And it was a very satisfying experience to do the bail project because we got to educate the court on an issue that before lawyers came in to do these hearings, nobody was really talking about. Because before the bail project happened, there wasn't a prosecutor or a defense attorney in the bail hearings. The only time you'd see a prosecutor walk in is if it was a serious case and they would make sure that the bail was set at a certain amount or no bail.
Yeah, and John, in terms of that burden of proof, if a judge wants to detain a defendant pending trial, that judge, at least for danger to the community, has to find that no condition or combination of conditions is going to ensure the safety of the community. So they have to say, even if I release the defendant with house arrest, with electronic monitoring, with a no contact order, et cetera, even if I throw all these conditions at the defendant, still by clear and convincing evidence, I still think there's a danger to the community. And so that is the standard they have to satisfy, as opposed to just saying, I think there are reasonable conditions I can impose and I'm going to set a bail, I'm going to have other conditions, and I'm going to allow the defendant to be released if he meets those conditions.
So it sounds like it's quite a tightrope walk for attorneys representing defendants because, as you said, the judge in Adnan's case kept saying, I'm not trying the case yet. So you have to present just enough evidence for your side. I mean, how do you pick?
Carefully. I think what Colin brought up was a really good point. And again, you know, how things get forgotten over time. In addition to offering to surrender Adnan's passport, because that was one of the things that Pretrial, who's an independent agency, that was the first actual person to speak after the facts were given by the prosecutor, is that they recommended that Adnan's bail remain the same at the writ. And the reason that they gave is one, that he had a passport. The judge challenged him on it. So, well, lots of people have passports. And the next thing they said is that they were concerned about his risk of flight and the seriousness of the charge. We hear that all the time. And then they said that there is a concern that the parents are of another nationality and are from another country. And with all that was presented at the time about Adnan's being born here, all the contacts and so forth he had here, this was a really troubling statement. But to counter that is that in addition to all that was done, the multiple houses that were put up, is just that one thing that some of the readers who've looked over this stuff, and I know people pay really close attention, is the reference to Ms. Charlene Dunn, that she was a home detention person that we had contacted who is prepared to put Adnan on house arrest. So even though the equipment has improved some since that time back in 99, the fact is that we were basically saying take him out of an adult jail where he doesn't belong and restrict his freedom as much as you possibly can, short of keeping him in a cage. And the home detention plus multiple houses, I remember when we walked out of there after we got the decision in particular, that we're just scratching our head and say, well, what more can anybody do to show reasonably that they're ready to submit to the jurisdiction of the court? And what we were met with was what ended up being inaccuracies and factual misrepresentations. And that really, to this day, still drives me insane to know that a decision was made, this information was presented to the judge, and it was information that was factually incorrect. And it always seems to have this extra specter of credibility when some expert sitting in the Department of Defense is saying, this is what the pattern is, and this is what is going on there. And, you know, it really frustrates me, and I sure hope that Judge Welch sees the injustice here and gives him a fair bail condition.
Yes, when he gets back from fly fishing. I hope so. As of now, there's two things pending. There is the current appeal of Judge Welch's ruling, but then also this bail. And one is before the Court of Special Appeals and one is before the Circuit Court. How does that work? Does one supersede the other?
Well, as I understand, what's pending is that because the appellate process is so slow, and there's a lot of reasons for that. It's not that there's, you know, inept folks. We actually have some really excellent judges on both the Court of Special Appeals and Court of Appeals, but the caseload and the way that the cases get handled on appellate is very different than a circuit court docket. And having had the case go, you know, turbocharged through the Court of Special Appeals before, with a ruling being granted without actually any hearing on it, was just such an anomaly. And all of us knew, wow, this case is really getting a very different treatment. And I'm glad that it was, because it was the right thing. But now that it's going in the more normal course, you know, Adnan is likely to sit there for quite a long time before that ruling happens on whether Judge Welch's decision to grant him a new trial was correct. So that's why the circuit court order would happen. And that's why, Justin, my guess is brought it there to be heard. It doesn't mean that if he's asking to cancel out the fact that there's an appeal pending, he's filed his briefs and filed his response to that. But it's just simply saying, look, there's no reason to keep this person sitting in a jail cell who's now supposed to return back to square one, where he's presumed innocent again. He's been granted a new trial. Allow him to have all of the ability to assist his defense counsel, which no client incarcerated could ever hope to have the same ability to assist their attorney the same way that a client that's released on bail. It's just simply not possible. It's not.
I actually got a question from social media that I found interesting. This is from Shanna Nguyen, who says, if Adnan gets out on bail, does that mean he's under no pressure to accept an Alford plea, forcing the state to either go to trial or drop the charges?
That's an interesting question. It's a very personal decision for a client. I know a lot of cases that have happened before Adnan that folks know about, that when a defendant or an accused gets placed in the position of rolling the dice and having a retrial versus getting their freedom immediately, often opt for the Alford plea. It would be something that Adnan would have to sit down with his current defense team and decide, even with him being out. Certainly there's more pressure when somebody's in and looking for their freedom and to regain their freedom, but still there's always risks with going back to court. Certainly the record's been built so beautifully by so many people that it's hard to imagine that a retrial would be successful in this case. And my hope is that ultimately, as that decision gets made, once the Court of Special Appeals gets done with the appeal, that's another important decision that needs to get made, is whether the case should be retried.
Yeah, I mean, Adnan is now 35. He's been incarcerated since he was 17. If this entire appeals process plays out, it goes all the way to the Court of Appeals of Maryland, who upholds it, and there's a new trial. I mean, he could be incarcerated for another 3 years or so, unless he's given pretrial release. So you can imagine how, in the decision-making process, being released versus facing another 3 years could play into that role of, am I going to accept a plea deal or not? And, you know, obviously, as Chris notes, there's other reasons that might militate against or in favor of a plea deal. But certainly, that, I think that would be a pretty important consideration.
And for the people that don't feel the way I feel about the case, and I understand there's plenty out there, in terms of their assurance that in addition to a house arrest, in addition to multiple properties being pledged and so forth, is that it's very common that the courts in Baltimore City in particular will order both a bail to be posted and numerous conditions on that bail and pretrial release services to supervise the person. So if there's folks out there listening that say, you know, well, I really have a problem with putting a murderer on the street because I believe he did this, or I have questions about whether he did this, well, he can have as much as a weekly supervision with a neutral agent who acts similar to a probation agent that monitors every single thing that he does while he's out. And that system has worked very well, and it's worked well in homicide cases before. So I know that there's many, many non-financial conditions that can assure that a just release is done and that people's fears are allayed.
And just out of curiosity, the bail filing, how long are bail filings generally dealt with? Because again, Justin laid out an enormous amount of the facts of the case in the bail filing. Does that lengthen the amount of time that a judge has to take to consider it?
Well, I could say that this is such an unusual trajectory of a case that it's very rare that we're talking about somebody getting a retrial and having the whole issue of bail being addressed in this depth. So it's kind of hard when you don't have a whole lot of cases to look back on and say, okay, well, this one took this long or that one took that long. It's going to be interesting. But certainly, that's just like the decision about how much information you get into in a bail hearing, where you get to the point where they think that you're trying the case somehow during the hearing. The same thing has to be decided by lawyers when they make their filings. And I think that because there's been pushback, Justin's carefully laying out all the detail in as much detail as he possibly can, and I applaud him for that.
Yeah, actually, at one point, Rabia said that the courts weren't aware of the disarray of the state's evidence, and that that was one of the reasons that Justin put all that information in the filing. But I wonder, you know, how can judges function day to day without hearing about a case that's in the news like this? Just on a day to day basis, do they just turn off their computers? I mean, what do you do?
I guess that they're kept pretty busy with other cases is one of the answers. And, you know, for those of us that watch and research and continue to listen to what's out there, not everybody shares sort of our penchant for doing that. But I guess we'd have to address that to the judges themselves.
One piece of information that really surprised me was that Adnan was 8 years from the possibility of parole. I think a lot of listeners didn't know that that was even a possibility. I mean, obviously, it's a fraught thing because he doesn't admit guilt, and that's usually a part of the parole process. So does that figure into how all of this is playing out?
Well, I think it raises an important issue that Professor Brian Stevenson has done so much for, which is the changing face of how we deal with juvenile folks in the system. Certainly his Miller versus Alabama case that he argued for the Supreme Court is now going to keep a lot of lawyers in the public defender's office really busy. And the announcement of reviewing all these cases of juvenile lifers who are in there for parole, it's a really unfortunate thing when we have all these mechanisms and tools to try to achieve a just result. And then oftentimes, again, because of habit, it will be, well, you know, you have this tool that might actually make sense and achieve justice. But if you don't admit your guilt, well, then it's a non-starter. We don't go past that. And I suppose one of the arguments that I've made to the people that just don't see this case the way that I do is I say, for Pete's sakes, the guy was 17 at the time when he did this. He's a grown man now. They took the best years away from him of his life. If that's not enough, you know, just to look at that on its own, whether you think the guy did this or not. And it's my hope that as all these things are converging now, the retrial, the bail motion, so forth, that the case has and continues to be, due to the hard work of a lot of people and some of them in that studio there with you, that our criminal justice system needs a hard look at how we handle things. It really does. And there's lots and lots of things that can be improved on the parole front, on the bail front, on the trial front. And knowing how much time has gone in is one of the things that when I teach part-time as an adjunct and I talk to students about this, as I say, this case illustrates so much effort had to go into bringing out the basic facts to light here. And that is not the way that the system allows us to perform our job on a day-to-day basis. It's much, much different. And it should all cause us concern and pause that if we really do believe in the principles of we would rather let 10 guilty folks go than to let one innocent person sit. And now you've got a DNA Innocence Project, you know, evidence of years and years and decades now of people that sat for years and didn't do the crime. It really is something that I think our time is ripe to really review how we handle these cases, all criminal cases, not just ADNOC's.
And it's worth noting that that potential of parole is an illusion. The last time Maryland granted parole for a lifer was like, what, mid-90s?
Yeah.
So in terms of the brief, to a person like somebody who listens to Undisclosed, say, the brief seems like a slam dunk. You know, it refutes every prong of what the state has to represent to, you know, maintain that Adnan should stay in jail. But I would imagine that for a judge, the biggest thing that keeps them from granting bail in these situations is simply inertia, is simply that the state has always felt that this person is guilty and was rightfully convicted and shouldn't get out and about. Is there any way to combat what is, you know, basically just a feeling of momentum that judges seem to have?
Well, all criminal defense attorneys know that one of their most valuable tools is persistence. And being able to continue to come at it and to continue to show that you care enough to come at it is something that I think really is what I've seen is really the number one reason for how injustices get undone. So, yeah, it's an uphill battle, and it shouldn't be, but it is. And it's a concern, and in some of those concerns in terms of what I talked about before, about how judges are treated when something goes wrong, when somebody's released. But if the rules are applied here, my hope is that, you know, we will get to see a release on a reasonable set of bail conditions. And certainly there's enough folks that are supporting Adnan that will come to his aid. And it's really heartwarming.
Now, one thing that Colin mentioned in this last episode was that because Adnan's conviction has been vacated, that he's technically not eligible for parole. Did I misunderstand that, Colin?
Well, the point I was making is that because he is no longer convicted, he cannot be given parole. He can be bailed out because the Maryland law specifically says if a judge vacates a conviction, he can then set bail. But because he no longer has a conviction, he could not get parole. But of course, he wouldn't be eligible for parole until at least 8 more years.
Oh, another thing. One of the things you guys mentioned in the podcast was the Nicholas case in terms of Christina Gutierrez not being familiar with lividity evidence or not being able to understand it. And I don't remember that case. Could you guys fill us in a little bit on that one?
Yeah, this was the case of Richard Nicholas, and it went to trial in 1997. This is the father who was alleged to have killed his daughter. And his claim was that he had taken her to see a movie, and after the movie, there was sort of a road rage type incident and the other driver had killed his daughter, whereas the prosecution's claim was that he had bought tickets for the movie and killed his daughter before the movie and gone and watched the movie by himself and pretended that he had watched this movie. And there was lividity evidence presented at trial in which the medical examiner made claims that essentially he later withdrew about lividity. But then after the conviction, there was a Public Information Act request, and it turned out that the prosecutors, first of all, said lividity was the whole case, but then also said they knew from an unimpeachable source that defense counsel Christina Gutierrez did not understand the significance of the lividity evidence. And the question always was, who was the unimpeachable source? But that was the Nicholas case with his father alleged to have killed his daughter.
Yeah, again, where would they possibly get that information?
Well, I've been looking into the case some more, and actually people might have seen on Twitter, there was additional information in there where the prosecutors in the case said they would have liked to have been a fly on the wall, and they wondered if the Scream team was screaming after what happened with the lividity evidence. So that has led me to think that it was definitely someone on Gutierrez's team, probably who was screamed at by Gutierrez, as I'm guessing what happened. I mean, it's just a guess. And they sort of went to the prosecutors and were unhappy and said, listen, Gutierrez didn't understand the lividity evidence, and this led to an uncomfortable situation. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job in all the top sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There's no juggling of emails, no calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, Undisclosed listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed.
So I've got some Twitter questions that I wanted to get to. Here's another one. If Adnan's case went to retrial, could the state change their theory of the case, or must they stick to their original theory?
They can change it. Yeah, I mean, they can present a new timeline. They could present a new theory of exactly what happened. But the defense, of course, then would have the opportunity to use the prior testimony and evidence presented at the first trial to impeach witnesses and to undermine the credibility of the state's new theory.
Okay, I got a question from Between the Tweets, who says, if the undisclosed team were to play devil's advocate, what would be their best argument on the state's part against bail for Adnan?
That there's no real downside to them to not granting it?
Well, that's pretty callous, if you ask me.
Why take the risk? Why be the judge who puts his skin on the line even more than he already has for no gain?
Well, it has the advantage of being brief. That's for sure.
I mean, yeah, if you're the state, you basically argue this was a person who was convicted of murder, kidnapping, false pretenses, and robbery. Those are very significant crimes. While based upon new Maryland decision making, there's the possibility of parole, it's still exceedingly unlikely he would be paroled, which means that if he's convicted again, he's likely to spend the rest of his life behind bars. And I mean, that's, we still have Jay Wilds. While he's undermined his credibility, he has never fully recanted. That, I guess, would be what the state argues, is the severity of the charge against Adnan, the witness for the prosecution still being there, and I guess that's the long and short of it, really.
Well, that's a good one. Sure. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's not to undermine it because obviously it being just a murder case, there is significant, just inherent in a murder charge, there's the inherent flight risk and the inherent danger to the community. So, I mean, those are certainly significant considerations that weigh on the state side.
Yeah. Oh, and one other kind of dumb question. What was the robbery charge that he was convicted of? What substantiated that?
Stealing Hayes, like contents of her purse and her keys in the car.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I have another good, interesting Twitter question. Allison Snake says, given Jay's strangulation reveal, do you think there's something to the man who reported suspicious mail at Lincoln Concrete Barrier?
I mean, I still wonder about that, but I don't wonder any more or less because of the bail motion. But we'll never know. The cops instantly dismissed it, never really checked it out. They didn't even really try and figure out the date when this happened. So...
yes, and it seems like Jay knows so little about the actual crime that there's no evidence to suggest that he was actually involved in any way, to my way of thinking.
Right, yeah, I mean, obviously the legal filing is presenting evidence to show, A, we can undermine Jay's credibility, and B, in the event of a retrial, there is evidence that the jury could consider to say there's someone else who committed the crime. But I think all of us, or at least Susan, myself, and Rabia, I think are on the same page that we think that Jay was uninvolved in the crime. But legally speaking, certainly there's the evidence there, and the fact that he himself said he was involved, that would then make fair game these other incidents that tend to show a certain pattern of behavior.
And especially its ability to counteract any kind of random character evidence the state might try and throw at Adnan and say, oh, look, he skipped class sometimes. He could totally be a killer. Well, you weigh that against Jay, their state star witness, and his background, and it starts making the stuff they're throwing at Adnan look pretty insignificant.
Now, actually, we've gotten a couple of interesting posts from people who were kind of annoyed at a recent episode of The Addendum where we talked about Sarah Koenig's recent interview on a podcast called Criminal Injustice. There's been some irritation that her comments were misrepresented and that this all seemed terribly ungrateful. And I just wanted to address it just from my point of view. I believe I did misrepresent something in terms of I said that she – I believe I phrased it as that she had mixed feelings about Judge Welsh's ruling –
vacating Adnan's case. And I think I did misstate that. I think I felt that she felt that there might have been flaws in his ruling, and she just brought them up. But I took it to mean when she said it that she felt that there were flaws, and that was probably misunderstanding what she was representing. But what I did have an issue with and remain having an issue with was that Sarah Koenig had largely felt that the system worked and that there were no bad guys, which is what she said. Also, several people felt that we hadn't listened to the interview, and I had, actually. I'd listened to it in its entirety. But I felt like it seemed odd to me because it seemed that she's a dedicated and gifted reporter, and it seemed very odd to ignore the evidence of police and prosecutorial misconduct in this case. So obviously, when the conversation happened on the show, Amelia McDonald Perry was a guest on the show, and she had very strong feelings about it. But I just wanted to express on behalf of the show much, much gratitude and respect for the reporting of Sarah Koenig has been mentioned. Rabia has gone on and on to great length of how grateful she is for what she's done for Adnan's case and bringing it to the public at large. But I stand by my criticisms of Sarah Koenig's odd blind spot for what seems to me to be real evidence of prosecutorial misconduct. But, you know, obviously that's her prerogative as a reporter. Some people felt that she was owed an apology, and I believe that may be my fault because I stated she had mixed feelings about something, and I think that was a misstatement. So on that level, I do apologize, but I stand by the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, you know, it's tough. We're on here in the podcast, and you're sort of shooting from the hip sometimes in terms of what you're saying. I don't think that when she made her comments on the podcast that she was saying that the system worked entirely perfectly. I think her point was more about bad faith versus good faith. And this sort of goes back to what Chris was mentioning, what you mentioned about, for instance, Vicky Wash at the bail hearing. I think certainly Sarah Koenig would acknowledge, and I think probably said it on Serial itself, that that was a gross misstatement of the facts by Vicky Wash. And I think her point is more along the lines of she didn't think that that was malicious. She didn't think that Kevin Urich retaining Jay's attorney, Ann Benaroya, the pro bono attorney, was something that was done maliciously. So that would be sort of my take on what she's saying with these things, is she sort of views things, I don't think is going smoothly in Adnan's case, but I think that she sort of ascribes it to mistakes as opposed to bad faith.
But it seems to me that there is evidence of some bad faith to some degree. And it's odd for a journalist who is by nature inquisitive and obviously very talented as she is to ignore that. That was the point I was making.
Yeah, I think that's a fair counterpoint. I just, in terms of overall construing her arguments, I think maybe some of the reaction might be along the lines of thinking that it was unfair to characterize Sarah as saying everything went smoothly here. I don't think that's entirely what she was saying. But again, it's tough because you sort of just have, again, shooting from the hip during an interview as opposed to something that she's, you know, written out and prepared and said, I believe this is exactly how things went in the trial. But yeah, again, it's tough to say without sort of sorting it out with her directly.
Well, that's all I've got for this week. Does anybody have anything that they want to bring up?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I was looking for some of those documents that I referred to, the transcript and so forth, you see some of the folks kind of calling me and dug out for things that, you know, we should own and that we could have done better and so forth, you know, and that comes with the territory. And I guess now my hope and feeling is that I've had a pretty long career. Folks know me, well, at least I hope they know me as somebody that really cares about the ethics of what I do. And that just watching this case crumble is really the way I want to handle it, because just at every turn, stuff that folks have said, well, this is the absolute way that it happened. And then to find out, well, there's no way it could have happened that way, is just, you know, what really is gratifying. And something that just really bears repeating that was mentioned in the original Serial podcast is, folks that don't do this work, you know, they always talk about us defense attorneys, like, you get the guilty guy off, you know, you let a guilty guy go free, you made it look like he didn't do it, but he really did it. But nobody really likes to talk about the ability of a prosecutor, whether it's intentional or not, to be able to package a case and convince a jury or a judge of something that's not accurate, and that some person pays that price and sits in a cage for the rest of their life, or for the best years of their life. And that's something that I think when we look at and when we apply as jurors that are called to jury duty about why it's so important to have a burden beyond a reasonable doubt and what that really means and what's at stake and the significance of it. It's just something that I hope for as I watch the system change little by little. And there's been a lot of great, you know, advances, But there are things that have certainly concerned me in this case, and it's nice to see things going in a positive direction.
Well, I think that's it for this particular episode. I want to thank you guys so much for being here. Chris, it was totally a pleasure, and thank you once again.
Thank you.
That's a wrap.
Take care, guys.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, guys.
All right. Thanks.
Catch you later.
Well, that is it for this special episode of The Addendum. This week, I'm actually going to highlight, once again, the Adnan Syed Legal Trust. Now that Adnan's conviction has been vacated, another trial means more legal fees, more money needed to follow up on tips, more money to talk to potential witnesses. Now, Adnan has been incarcerated for more than 16 years. He is unable to pay for his own defense. He needs financial help in order to fund the chance to win back his freedom. I have given, and I will be giving more, and I can't thank all the others who've already given enough. Let people know that now is the time to join in the struggle to free Adnan. Now, if you haven't yet donated, please consider doing so. Your money will go directly to Adnan's defense and associated investigative efforts. If Adnan is released without retrial, acquitted or otherwise exonerated, or if Adnan exhausts his appeals, the remaining money will be held in trust for Adnan to use or donate as he wishes. So we sincerely hope that you will help Adnan by donating. Just Google LaunchGood Adnan Syed and you'll be off to the races. Thanks so much. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at hashtag undisclosed or hashtag justice for Joey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use hashtag UD addendum, or you can tweet them directly to me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, if you've got any worthy organizations, I know I said I was all full up. I was wrong. We're actually going to extend the season a little bit, so I will need more. So please let me know of more organizations that are helping the wrongfully convicted. And as always, there's new case documents and photos posted at the undisclosed-podcast.com website, so please check those out. And you can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @undisclosedpod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed the addenda theme, and Mithil Telhan as our project manager. And I'm going to make a little announcement. Unfortunately, next week I will not be available to record the addendum. I will miss you guys, but I cannot wait to see you guys in Washington, D.C. on November 17th for our live recording of the addendum. I could not be more excited about meeting the fans and talking about the show. And thank you once again for listening this week. Have a good one.